Welcome to the People of Canterbury Baptist, a podcast where we meet the people of Canterbury Baptist Church in Melbourne, Australia, and hear their stories and explore ideas relevant to our church and community. My name is Stephen, and for today's episode, we're doing something a little different. We'll be talking with Ken about his new book, Higher Right, First Time. Ken, it's a privilege to be able to have you join us here on the People of Canterbury Baptist podcast.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Stephen. I'm absolutely delighted.
Now, ordinarily in this podcast, we would talk about your life story, but today we're not actually going to go there. I had the privilege a number of weeks back of attending a book launch for a book that you launched, funnily enough, called Higher Right, First Time. That is a practical guide for staffing Christian organizations, a book that you co-wrote with Peter Corney. And the great privilege of hearing you talk about this book, and I thought it might be valuable or of interest to people in our congregation and maybe further afield to hear about the particular take and the particular emphasis that you have within this book itself. So maybe as a way of getting into our conversation, can I ask you maybe to give me the elevator pitch? If we're stuck on an elevator for 2 minutes and you said, hey, I've written a book, and I said, oh, what's the book about? Yep. How would you answer that question?
Christian organizations do an uneven job of hiring people. The mistakes that are associated with hiring are enormous, far more than most people ever calculate. And there is a way to do it much better.
That's the elevator pitch.
That's it.
Got me interested. So this is a book focused on Christian organizations. Yes. Are you aware of other books in the market that speak about hiring within Christian organizations?
There are a couple of books which are hiring for churches. There are no other books written, to my knowledge, on hiring for a broad range of Christian organizations, which is one of the things that motivated us to write this book.
So you found almost a gap in the market and you want to be able to plug that gap. But I guess the question I have is why? What are the needs that you've seen within Christian organizations that have inspired you to provide these resources for them?
For the last 22 years, I've taught at a group called the Arrow Leadership Group. And this is across Australia, one of the best known Christian leadership training groups. And every year I do several times a year, I do a talk on how to deal with people who were hired who shouldn't have been hired. And I ask a group of people, do you have anyone like this? And everyone raises their hand. And then I hear, well, how did you inherit this person, or how is the hiring decision made? And hear the most astonishing stories. One is a man was arrested and jailed for white-collar crimes. He embezzled money. And while he was in jail, the wife's family supported her and the children, but then he was released, and they said, well, you know, we've done as much as we can. So that the organization, who had a series of churches, decided to get him a job as a groundskeeper. And they didn't tell anyone about his background because they thought it'd be good to give him a fresh start. So for a couple of months, he worked clipping hedges and gardening and cutting grass. And then someone said, gee, our bookkeeper has left. Do you know anyone who knows anything about bookkeeping? So our hero says, oh, yes, I know about bookkeeping. And he gets a bookkeeper's job. Would you like to guess the end of the story?
I'm guessing it didn't end well.
It didn't end well. He defrauds the church. He goes back to jail and loses his family. Now, did we do him any favors by putting him into that job? No. Could the church have foreseen this? No, they couldn't have. But they might have warned the people who run the church that this is the person's background. Or when they started looking for someone, instead of just finding some handy person, they might have asked around and got a wider field of candidates.
Is there a particular vulnerability in Christian organizations because we come from a Christian ethic in which we tend to more highly prize forgiveness and generosity and giving people a second chance? Does that actually make Christian organizations maybe more vulnerable to making poor hiring decisions?
In my opinion, yes. Now, poor hiring decisions go across everywhere. But churches, number one, attract people because of their values. They attract people because they want to be helpful and make a contribution. Christian organizations have in their DNA the desire to spread God's word by action or by deed. And they are very tolerant of people. And so I found students who thought that asking more challenging questions was being rude, and so they didn't want to ask questions like that. And so you then have very superficial interviews. And Christian organizations tend to hire people very quickly, and then they take forever to fire them. That formula should be reversed. They should take a long time to hire and then fire people quickly.
Your book is incredibly practical. I have read through it. It's only 150 pages. So when we say book, this isn't some sort of massive academic tome. It's written in very clear, plain English. And as a pastor of a church, I found it very helpful because short, succinct sections, clearly headed, so it'll be very easy for me to use it as a reference material. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I found striking about it was you also got very specific within the book as well. Mm-hmm. So you didn't just sort of give vague hints of, you know what, it's good to ask, you know, specific questions of people, you know, whatever. You actually even came down and asked or suggested very specific questions that that should be asked of people. What motivated you not just to do a general guide, but to even go down to the level of detail where you're giving us the exact wording you're suggesting we should we should ask for very specific questions that you believe should be asked in an interview?
I've spent a bit more than 40 years as a corporate psychologist, and I've trained well over 2,000 people in the public service and the private service. And what I've found is that as soon as you give people room to improvise the questions, they ask leading questions or they ask a question which really isn't the point. So as an example, I was in a coffee shop once killing time between appointments, and there were two people within earshot, and it became clear that one was a job interview. And the interviewer said to the candidate, "Now, this job requires working with people from a whole different range of economic and socioeconomic backgrounds. I guess with your experience, you wouldn't have much trouble with that, would you?" Now, what's a candidate going to say? "Gee, funny you mentioned that I would have trouble." Of course, the candidate says, "Oh, no, I wouldn't have trouble at all." So she ticks that off her list. Not that she had any lists or any notes. So by having the questions well thought out, written in advance in a structured interview guide, you know what you want to ask, in what order, and what each question is designed to elicit. And when they're written down, several things happen. Ideally, you have two people doing the interview. So one person is having the conversation, not worth making notes, but the other person is making notes of what's said. Then halfway through, you change places, and the interviewer at first starts taking notes, and the other person takes over asking questions. And then when you're finished, you have a written record of what was said. Otherwise, if you're trying to compare two candidates, even the ones you've seen on the same day, memory is very, very fallible. So you then have a written record of what people said, and if you've asked exactly the same questions, you can compare the person statement by statement by statement to how well they answered it.
In your book, your book's very systematic and it's very orderly. So pretty much from chapter 1 to chapter 12, you're taking the reader step by step through the process of formulating and preparing for the interviews, of even how to write the position description in a way that attracts the sort of candidates you're looking for, the structure that you should set up within a selection criteria, how to ask the questions in an interview and giving sometimes very specific examples of questions that should be asked to elicit the information. But you also spend a lot of time, I think, on things which I'd never really thought too deeply on. So you spend, for example, a whole chapter on discovering the candidate's workplace beliefs and values, and you give very specific questions and very specific strategies. I like this one. You had one which said so this is a question that you're suggesting we should ask to a candidate. So I would ask the candidate, when you're looking for a prospective job, what's most important for you to feel satisfied? Mm-hmm. That question is within the context of a question that draws out their beliefs and values. So whatever their response is, we're listening for a sense of their beliefs and values. But the thing which I really loved about it is then you said, after you've listened to the answer and listened carefully, you repeat the question.
Yes.
I don't think I've ever read anything like that before. And you say, you repeat the question with this twist. You say, well, okay, if you did receive that satisfaction, well, what's the next most important thing for you? Mm-hmm. And then you suggest you ask again, well, what is the next most important thing after yes. that? Drawing out their beliefs and values. Why is this so important? And this particular strategy of being willing to almost repeat the questions to keep drilling down, why is that so important?
Well, first of all, most people don't know what their beliefs and values are. They may have some idea, but they don't really know them. And remember that in an interview, everyone comes wearing a mask. Everyone comes there to persuade you that they're the best candidate. How many people have you interviewed, Stephen, who've said, you know, I think I'd be really good for this church, and, you know, I have experience in this other church, and you see I've got this degree in divinity. You should know, though, that I sort of irritate people because when things go wrong, I blame someone else.
Yeah.
No one's going to tell you that. No. But if you ask the right questions, you can find that out. So in this question, the reason we ask it three times is because people's beliefs and values are multifaceted. We sometimes even ask it five times. But then what's more important is, so for example, a common answer is, when I feel a sense of recognition. All right, thanks. Now, if you had recognition, what would be the next most important thing? And you get the three criteria. But then you go back and ask what are called anchor points. How can you tell in your heart of hearts when you feel recognized?
Yeah.
I remember one person who said, I have to have it in writing. So I told his boss, don't tell him he's done a good job because it doesn't mean anything. Send him a memo. And when I got to know the man better, he was a client of ours, I saw in his office he had framed around the wall these memos he'd had from different bosses. That's what had so much meaning to him. For other people, recognition can mean something different else. Something different. They'll say, when I've been given a very tough assignment. So the boss should say, now, Fred or Mary Jane, we have a very tough assignment, but I know you can do it. That rings a bell in the person's unconscious, and they say, gee, I'm feeling recognized.
You go on in your book, you talk about, you know, having developed these questions and set up the interview. You then talk about the incredible importance of listening, which you define very differently to hearing. Can you just unpack a bit of the difference between listening and hearing?
Sure. Well, hearing is registering a sound. Your ear registers that something has been said. But hearing is listening very intently for what the person wants to communicate and what it is they're getting across, even though they might not be aware of it. And so in listening, one of the things we want to listen for are what are called throwaway lines, things that people say without being aware of it. And most interviewers pay no attention to this. There's one woman I recall interviewing, she said, as a throwaway line, she said, yeah, I'm really a child at heart. And then she went on in a conversation. And I later found out that her hobby was dollhouses. And I asked her about her hobby, and she began speaking in this little girl's voice as she took the voice of one of the dolls. Now, does that mean you hire or don't hire her? No, but it does tell you something very important about who she is as a person. Another guy said to me, I said, how's your style? What would you say is your style of managing people? And he said, oh, look, some people would work for me and said, I'm a bit like Hitler, but I was only joking.
Wow.
Now, I'll tell you the real answer is, and he gave me the real canned, prepared answer. But the throwaway line is where the clue was. So hiring is about getting a series of clues about a person and trying to put all those clues together to find out who this person really is behind the mask.
In that chapter, you actually outline six subtle clues to listen for. And we won't spoil it. Let's get people to buy the book and they can find out what those six clues are for themselves. But can I name one which sure. I thought was very interesting, and I'd never registered this before. You said listen for lack of emotion.
Yes.
Where a person's emotions and their words are not lining up. Can you just unpack why that's a clue to be listened for?
Well, sure. Some people describe things in an emotion doesn't match what they're talking about. So I'm thinking of a man who described having to retrench a series of staff. But there was no element of sadness. There was no sense of how this would affect people who were being retrenched. And I asked him after hearing the story how he felt about doing it. And he said, well, we had to get rid of some dead wood, so it was a good thing. Now, that tells you a lot about a person.
Your book then goes on. You talk about the importance of reference checks. You actually really lean in on this. You often talk about reference checks being often the last thing that people do and the thing that people are feeling most exhausted by the process. So it's almost the thing they do most perfunctorily. It becomes a checker box
exactly.
exercise. And you put a lot of effort into really giving specific and key and important questions that gets asked. And you even, in a final chapter, you even talk about potentially dangerous employees, particularly in a world in which we're much more aware of sexual abuse and other things that are truly horrendous. And how the reference check is actually an incredibly important moment to be able to listen carefully for clues you're being given that people will not necessarily want to say out loud.
Exactly.
But they're communicating things to you that you really need to hear.
Exactly.
Of their concerns or the potential danger of a candidate, or maybe their relief that they're finally getting rid of a candidate.
Yes.
And asking, and you construct very specific questions around that. Is there any sort of comments that you like to make about the importance of a reference check?
Well, first of all, reference checking is the part of the hiring process that is consistently done badly. Recently, someone who worked for me many years ago applied for another job, and I got a text message from an employment agency, please press this link. So I pressed this link, and there was a questionnaire evaluating this person on a scale of 1 to 5. Now, that is somewhere between incredibly lazy or incredibly dishonest, because what they don't understand or don't want to understand is that reference checking is a kind of interview. And for the employer, even when they fired somebody, nobody wants to be the person to prevent someone from getting another job. So unless you ask the right questions, you never get the right answer. And it begins with getting rapport with the person. And then it begins asking, again, a series of very structured questions written down in advance to make sure you don't miss anything. And nobody wants to say they thought someone was a sexual abuser or a pedophile. But by asking the right questions, for example, did you ever have any cause for concern, or did anyone else who works for you have cause for concern about this person's ability to maintain the right boundaries between people? Now, that's not saying, is this person an abuser? Mm. But if they have some concern, it invites them to tell you that. And people will have a number of euphemisms. Instead of saying, I'd never hire this person again, they'll say, well, I think I'd go to the market first, which is a clue. But, you know, most people, so one client, the reference checking was done at the very last minute by a receptionist who had no experience at all in interviewing, no contact with candidates, and she had a simple checklist, 7 questions. Was this person a good employee? Yes or no. Did this person come to work on time? Yes or no. Did they abuse sick leave? Yes or no. I mean, it was a nonsense.
In your book, you draw it to a close where you unpack the process of making the final decision, how the committee then goes about actually picking one candidate amongst a sea of yep. other candidates. You also then give some incredibly detailed and helpful tips about dismissals for those moments when actually you do need to dismiss an employee.
Yes.
But then on the other side of the coin, you also talk about ways of keeping your best staff. So you've taken us pretty much from the beginning of the process to beyond the end of the process. But can I go back to one thing? You spend a chapter talking about the value of intuition, that is the value of tapping into your unconscious mind.
Yes.
Given how systematic and structured and well-organized and sometimes, you know, drafting out very specific phrases in very specific questions to tap into very specific parts of people's psychology. Given the way you presented this book, reading a chapter about the unconscious mind and trusting your intuition was a bit of a surprise given the context of everything else that you'd written in the book. Can you maybe unpack the value of intuition for us a little bit?
Well, intuition is a tremendously powerful way of learning about people. Let me give you an example. You're walking down the street in the city and it's 11 o'clock at night and you see someone walking towards you and you immediately get a sense that they're somewhat dangerous or to be avoided. And that comes instantaneously to your mind. Where does that come from? Now, if we could have a videotape, we could unpack a whole series of things about the way the person was walking, their body language, the way they were dressed, the look in their eyes, the way they glanced at you. But your intuition immediately told you there's danger. And intuition has two purposes, two factors. One is it's always based on incoming information, and it's always there to act in your best interests. And often when people, particularly if they're not experienced, they fall back on intuition. They'll say, well, there's something about this person I just like. I think they'd really fit in. Well, that's okay, but the way to test that out is to ask two questions. One of the questions is, if I had someone who I really cared about, would I want them to work with this person? And then there's some sub-questions. How would this person treat them when extra work was required? How would this person deal with negative feedback? And some other factors. Now, the question is designed to elicit this vague, amorphous, unconscious feeling you have and to put it into words and use it to make sense of what you're feeling about the person. And then, most importantly, we suggest getting that information and checking it against all the other factual information you have. And this is where you come to putting the puzzle pieces together to get an understanding of this person.
If people go and buy your book, Hire Right First Time, they don't just get a book, but they get an opportunity to go to a website to download a user's guide. What is this user's guide and what's the value of this additional booklet apart from the physical one you can buy?
Well, they can purchase the book on Amazon and they get two additional user's guide. One is we've created a specific interview technique for assessing interpersonal skills and assessing job-related skills. And frankly, we didn't want to make the book too thick. So it's in this user guide, and it spells out in great detail with many examples exactly how to use this technique. Secondly, in the book, as you know, there's a whole series of different forms for telephone interviews, interpersonal interviews, reference-checking interviews. In the second user guide, all those forms are there in a Microsoft Word format. So you can download them, and then once you get experience, you may decide some questions don't suit you. You just take those out. You can put your own company heading on them if you want to. You can add new questions if you want to, and really make it your own document to work with without having to retype everything in the book.
So it sounds like even though this is called a practical guide for staffing Christian organizations, actually this is a book that is useful to anyone who is looking to staff any organizations. Would that be fair?
I think that is fair.
Ken, mate, it's a great privilege to be able to sit down with you. Thank you for taking this time and really appreciated your book, Hire Right First Time. And I guess for anyone listening, if you're at a point where you're thinking about hiring new staff, then this can certainly be a book that we can recommend for you to be able to read and be able to take some very useful tips and hints and processes to help that be as robust a process as possible. Ken, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
And thank you to everyone who was tuned in to listen. If you'd like to purchase Ken's book, it's available on amazon.com.au. This podcast is produced and presented by Stephen Field on behalf of Canterbury Baptist Church, Melbourne, Australia. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email cbc@canterburybaptist.org. The music is a song, The First Step, by Andrew Naylor from his album, Two Stones. This album is available wherever you purchase or stream your music. Join us next time as we continue our chats with the people of Canterbury Baptist.